This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 23rd of September 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Aleppo and the ceasefire that has turned out to be merely a lull before an even more thunderous storm. Is there anything that a bewildered world can actually do? Guests from Monocle's editorial floor and from our New York bureau will be joining me to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the upcoming opening debate in the US presidential election. How do you win against someone who won't play by the rules? The overdue opening of Washington's National Museum of African American History and Sao Paulo's eventful mayoral election. All that and more coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House, today's episode of which is an in-house affair. All the guests are editors and producers here at Monocle 24, and they are Steve Bloomfield, our executive editor, Ed Stocker, our New York bureau chief, and Monocle 24 producers Marcus Hippie and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. We will start with Steve Bloomfield and Ed Stocker, and we will start in Aleppo, where what seemed the faintest flicker of optimism this time about a week ago, when a ceasefire was more or less agreed, has now been unceremoniously extinguished. The airstrikes, which have pounded the city over the last 24 hours or so, are reckoned to have been some of the heaviest Aleppo has endured in 5 years of war. Steve, it's becoming clear, well, it was already pretty clear, it's becoming even clearer that Syria especially, Russia to a slightly lesser extent, see Aleppo as the crucial battlefield. That's where this war will be won or lost.
That's true, yes. And yet we can see that, and yet no one is trying to stop them. You know, no one outside of Syria is doing anything really to prevent the Russians and the Syrian regime from winning Aleppo, as it were, and therefore essentially winning the war. And we have to make a decision, really, as within the West. Western leaders have to make a decision. Is that okay? Are they going to say, look, it's too difficult for us to get involved in this, so if the Russians want to, and if Assad wants to carry on killing his own people and take back control of his country if he can, we'll let him do it? Or are we going to do something about it?
The options for what they can do, not just militarily but especially politically, especially in the dying months of a U.S. presidency, are limited. John Kerry, the U.S. Secretary of State, was the person who got out in front of the ceasefire. Mm. Has he been played by the Russians?
It wouldn't be the first time. It's quite possible. I mean, look, John Kerry didn't have the backing from the Pentagon. You know, the Pentagon were quite open, really, about a week ago, about how they weren't really happy with the deal that Kerry had struck. And also, you know, if I were John Kerry, I'd be wondering where my boss is in all this, because Barack Obama is supposedly rather cut up about what's happened in Syria, but he has not given his full backing to what John Kerry's done. He hasn't made it a priority. And, you know, as you say, we're coming to the end of his presidency. One doesn't get the sense that he feels this is a burning priority that he feels he can try to fix in his final months.
But this is in keeping with Barack Obama's general demeanour regarding the Middle East, though, isn't it? Because where that's been possible, he has regarded it from the other end of an extremely long barge pole.
Yes, and let's not forget the context for this. He came into office at the start of 2009 when the US was still in Iraq, when the US was still in Afghanistan, two deeply unpopular wars. Afghanistan, because of the length of time it had taken and the fact that, well, once the Taliban had been ousted in late 2001, many people then wondered really what there really was to do still 8 years later. Iraq, obviously, he didn't want to be involved in the first place. He rather accurately described it as a dumb war back in 2002 before it began. So he was very keen to get out of both of those. There was much talk of the pivot to Asia. That didn't really happen because of the Arab Spring, and which we really, no one's really found a better name for that. I mean, it's a terrible name as it is.
It has been overtaken by events.
Yeah. But, you know, America couldn't turn away, just like other Western powers couldn't turn away from what was happening in Egypt, in Syria, in Libya. They had to have some sort of involvement or some sort of view about what was right and what was wrong. And, you know, in Libya, they got involved, but not to a great extent, and that didn't work out very well. In Syria, they didn't get involved, and that hasn't worked out very well. And, of course, in Iraq and Afghanistan, they did get involved, and that hasn't worked out very well.
The damned if you do, damned if you don't paradox, I guess. Ed Stocker in our New York bureau to bring you in. With all due deference to the conventional wisdom that foreign affairs don't win votes and certainly don't win elections, is what is happening in Syria registering at all amid the American media landscape at the moment as the election picks up steam?
Yes and no. I mean, a little bit, but obviously there's so much that's overshadowing events and being covered by the media here in the US. Not just obviously the presidential debate that we're about to talk about on Monday, but also that continued battle over race and policing. You know, what's been happening in Charlotte, North Carolina has been dominating, as you'd expect, the headlines here in the US. I think, you know, US TV news has always really tended to show more domestic events than international news anyway. And what with what's been happening in terms of the New Jersey and New York bombings, Charlotte and the presidential race and the circus that goes with it, Syria has somewhat slipped to the back of the line.
Which is hardly surprising. As you say, we will talk about that presidential debate shortly, but Steve, you were talking about, I guess we've been discussing, not for the first time, America's either impotence or indifference, where a lot of what is going on in Syria has been, or where a lot of it has been concerned. Syria is now talking about a ground offensive to retake what is left of Aleppo. Is there anything that anybody can actually do or should actually do to dissuade them? I mean, if you take a really brutally reductive, possibly even cynical view of what's going on in Syria now, isn't the least worst option just for somebody to win, whoever it is, so at least it stops?
No. I mean, I think, you know, wars obviously end in either one of two ways. Either you have a negotiated settlement or someone wins. So if we're talking about how do you end the war, well, obviously someone winning, that someone at the moment being Assad winning, would, I guess, end it. But no, that would be a disaster. Let's not forget, you know, he is the man who created this war. He is the man that dealt with a peaceful protest by killing his own citizens, and has led his nation to a point where it is split in several parts that will probably never be put back together again, and hundreds of thousands of people have died. He is the one who created the environment for ISIS to thrive. He's the one who let Sunni jihadis out of jail specifically so that they could join up with ISIS. So no, I don't think that's necessarily the least worst option. I think there are two things here. One is, you know, I can understand the reticence after Iraq for military involvement from the West in whether that is in actual troops on the ground, which obviously no one's even talking about now, or whether that is supplying weapons. And supplying weapons can often end in a sticky way all over the world. But there are other ways to intervene. You know, you can stop people's bank accounts. You can stop people sending their kids to Western schools. You know, there are things you can do to prevent people, to put pressure on people that isn't just about killing. And we're very bad at that. You know, when you look at all the talk about, you know, how do you put pressure on Russia? Well, for a start, you can stop them all sending their children to expensive schools here in London. But the UK isn't going to do that. So, you know, there are lots of things that can be done that aren't just about violence. We talk about intervention as if it has to be military, it has to be about death. It doesn't. You can intervene in different ways, but we're either not clever enough, or we, and this is the horrible thing, maybe we just don't think it's as important.
Okay, well, let's move along now and look ahead with due trepidation to Monday night and the first presidential debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. On paper, this should be a no contest. Clinton is a capable, experienced politician, and Trump is an impulsive, opportunist, orange game show host. But the very fact that Trump is on the bill reminds us that this has been a bad year for conventional wisdom, and Clinton finds herself having to prepare for the surely unpreparable. Ed Stocker, our New York Bureau Chief, is still with us. So is Steve in the studio. I mean, Ed, first of all, what do we know about how Clinton is approaching this? Where do you start trying to construct a game plan for debating Donald Trump?
Well, we know what Hillary Clinton's like, and we know that she is a very thorough preparer, and she's been doing exactly that. I mean, essentially what she wants to do, her goal on TV on Monday night at 9 p.m. here on the East Coast, is to rattle Donald Trump. You know, we've seen time and time again that him failing to tell the truth doesn't necessarily mean anything. It doesn't seem to affect him. So if he makes a preposterous claim on primetime TV, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to dent his popularity. So, you know, she's been looking into, we hear, the psychological makeup of Donald Trump and trying to work out what she can do to rattle him, because, you know, we know what a confident performer he is. If she's going to win this debate, she needs to show the American public that what she's been saying for a long time now, and what adverts from the Clinton campaign have been saying in terms of his temperament, the fact that he, in her view, is unfit to be the next president of the US. She needs to show that to the American people. And she needs to do that by making him either lose his temper or look decidedly rattled under the bright lights of the TV presidential debate. So that's one tactic. But I mean, she's been, you know, preparing. She's apparently going to be going through a mock debate over the weekend. She has advisors. She has a, you know, a debate advisor who's been with her some 16 years. She's going over possible questions, possible responses to things Donald Trump's going to be saying. You know, she's, like I said before, extremely thorough. And Donald Trump, on the other hand, seems to be doing very little indeed.
Steve, Ed's talking there about what Hillary Clinton needs to do to win this debate. But I'm just wondering, is the problem she faces that this is essentially asymmetrical warfare? They have different definitions of what victory will constitute.
Yes, and Hillary Clinton isn't helped by the fact that a lot of the media attention... Think back to when Donald Trump met with Enrique Peña Nieto in Mexico. He stood on a podium. He read some prepared notes. He shook Peña Nieto's hand and he looked serious. If you then turned on the US networks after that, it was full of, oh, wow, he looked presidential, didn't he? Donald Trump, no one expected that. Didn't he look presidential? And so that is Hillary Clinton's big thing, is that if he looks normal, and that's not hard, you know, he's a 70-year-old man who can wear a suit. He will stand there in his suit behind his podium.
He will look orange, but normal.
He'll look orange, but normal. Then there will be a lot of pundits who will go, well, you know, they said that, you know, that Donald Trump wasn't presidential. I thought he looked pretty presidential tonight, don't you? And I go, well, you know, I didn't really agree with him, but, you know, he didn't swear or say anything racist. So, yeah, he looks presidential. They have set the bar so low for him that he would have to set the podium on fire for Hillary Clinton to have a chance to win. So therefore,
I think actually a lot of his supporters would be pretty impressed by that.
I'm sure they would. Therefore, I feel that Hillary Clinton should not hold back. She should be, she shouldn't try and be cautious. She shouldn't try and sort of soft pedal it or rise above it anyway. She should go for him. She should, if you allow me to say this, she should beat the shit out of him on Monday night.
In what way, though? Do you think she should go after him on policy specifics, on detail, like ask him just to name the capital of Yemen? Tell me who is the president of Libya.
No, the capital of Yemen, that's not going to help. That's not going to help. She shouldn't look necessarily pompous or snobbish, but... You know, she can be like, right, fine, let's talk about healthcare. You know, this is my thoughts. What are your thoughts on this, Donald? I mean, the fact that even that question, what are your thoughts on healthcare, Donald, would probably stump him. You know, show what she's up against.
Ed, to come back to you, what do people feel about... I mean, it's usually thought that the debates are a great way to win over swing voters, but in this election in particular, are there any swing voters? Who are the imaginable people who are going to watch this debate between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and change their minds?
I just want to make a quick point to what Steve was saying. I think it's interesting that, in you know, he can be presidential, and I think one of the things that's difficult for Hillary is she's not necessarily going to know which Donald Trump is going to show up on the day. The unpredictability of him is what makes it perhaps a harder job for her than with conventional candidates. In terms of people watching and swing voters, I think people are just so fascinated. There's been so much hype. It's been a election cycle like no other. Whether they're swing voters or not, I mean, obviously, there's lots of Republican voters who haven't necessarily come out and declared it because they don't think that they'll be, I don't know, be well received for saying they'll vote for Donald Trump. So I think more than, you know, the people sitting on the fence, I think people are going to be watching just because they're hugely intrigued to see how much of a spark, how much Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump going face to face, how many difficult moments it's going to produce, how much it's going to be entertainment. After all, that's what the American people like often when it comes to politics. That's why millions of people tune in to these TV debates in the first place. They want controversy, they want entertainment, and I think, you know, we're going to get that on Monday night. It's going to be unpredictable.
Final quick thought from you on this one, Steve. What if, and this is just my swing for the fences suggestion for Hillary Clinton, just remind everybody they're actually really good friends. What if she just whips out the pictures of the Clintons at whichever one of Trump's weddings it was they went to?
Indeed. Or mentions the fact that Donald Trump has apparently switched political parties 5 times. There's only 2 parties. I mean, how do you do that? Or if she says, thanks, Donald, for all those donations you've made to me over the years. You helped me get where I am today. I mean, look, I think that would have, if she'd said those things about him a year ago during the Republican primaries, that might have helped. But, you know, I mean, he played that actually quite well during the primaries by saying, look, I'm a rich man and I know how to play the system and I make these donations to people and then they do what I want. But that system's stinks, and if you vote for me, that won't happen because I'm so rich.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up next, America's new African American Museum.
The well-turned-out, style-themed October issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. We tour the globe for the best in the world of retail, with a ranking of the companies and developers doing it best from Sydney to Seoul, past Porto and Poznan. Here's what our sharp-eyed editors have spotted for you this month.
In the design section, we set sail to Copenhagen to see the striking modernist headquarters of shipping giant Maersk.
In the edits pages, we make reservations at a late-night restaurant started by the talented souls behind Apartamento magazine in Barcelona.
Monocle's October issue is on newsstands now, or guarantee your copy by joining as a Monocle subscriber. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
Welcome back to the show. This is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me is Ed Stocker, our New York bureau chief, and our producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, joins us as well. Let's look at Washington, D.C. and a surely overdue addition to the parade of museums on the Mall, the National Museum of African American History and Culture, which opens tomorrow. Now, the story it tells will be, by definition, in many respects, unflattering to the United States, which may, of course, be part of the reason it has taken so long for such an institution to be established. established. It took until 2004 for the National Museum of the American Indian to be opened as well. Ed, first of all, how significant a milestone is this being seen as? It's in the most prime real estate for a museum in the United States imaginable. It's right there on the mall. There was talk of it for a while being exiled to an outer suburb, but there it is, absolutely unmissable.
Indeed, I think a lot of people, rightly so, talking about how overdue it is having a museum, looking at African-American history and culture. And it's not like this was without its controversy. You know, it was approved back in 2013, initiated 10 years ago, and it's finally, been finished and is opening on Saturday. There were problems over the $500 million funding, getting political support, and as you mentioned, finding a location originally slated to be on the outskirts of DC and then moved to its central location. But, you know, a lot of excitement, I guess added symbolism in the fact that Barack Obama is reaching the final months of his presidency, the US's first black president, still in power when it's opening. He'll of course be there on Saturday. And then, obviously some sadness that there are those continued issues over race, a disproportionate amount of black men that seem to be dying at the hands of police officers, all the events that have been taking place in Charlotte and elsewhere that we mentioned briefly earlier in the show, that in a way not overshadows it, but shows that there are still many continued issues at the heart of American society when it comes to race.
What do we know so far, Ed, about the contents of the museum, about the exhibits? Have they tried to be, to the extent that you can be, especially where reasonably recent history is concerned, have they tried to be relatively, I guess, academic and neutral? Or is this a museum which is taking a point of view and hopes to act as some kind of engine of progress as well?
Well, the first point to make is that it's not a museum that's aimed at African Americans. The aim of the museum is to be open and accessible to all. And it's got a very wide range of items in the collection. Obviously, it tackles big issues of slavery and segregation. Their Ku Klux Klan robes in there. There's a Bible that belonged to slave Nat Turner. But then you have, pop culture references. You have the other side. You have, obviously, there's a lot on Barack Obama himself. It's quite an incredible study, really. The director had 10 years without a museum, Lonnie Bunch, who was formerly of the Chicago History Museum. And him and his team have spent the last decade traveling around the US with his curators, searching for treasures that represented different aspects of African American life. So I think you'll find it's a pretty rounded and vast collection.
And to bring you in on this, Fernando, your native Sao Paulo opened something similar a while back.
Absolutely. And I agree with Ed. I think both our nations, Brazil and the U.S., have similar history, with slavery. We have a museum called Afro Brazil. It was opened in Sao Paulo in 2004 in a beautiful building designed by Oscar Niemeyer. I've been there once myself, and it is a beautiful museum. And again, it was open. It was our former president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, he wanted to create a museum to show, the vast culture, that the African diaspora brought to Brazil. And it was excellent exhibitions. I remember I saw one about the black community and Brazilian football. Because if you look at our best players, the majority of them are black, including Pelé. So it's nice that they had also not only the history, the historical and terrible past of slavery, but also new things like with music, football, and other categories as well.
Okay, well, Ed Stocker in New York, thanks for joining us. We're going to stay in Fernando's native Sao Paulo for our next story. These are the upcoming regional elections in Brazil, which we should take a look at, not least to understand how the publisher of a magazine, which is actually called Caviar Lifestyle, can be a viable mayoral candidate in Sao Paulo or indeed anywhere. We should discuss this candidate first, Fernando, because this is, I mean, I don't know Sao Paulo at all, but what percentage of its citizens do you think would regard themselves as leading a caviar lifestyle?
Well, the circulation of the magazine is 40,000, so I presume around 40,000.
That's actually not bad.
Exactly. You know, and it's very interesting. I mean, João Dória, the candidate we're talking, he's from the center-right party, PSDB. He's well-known among Brazilians because he's also a TV presenter. He has his show called Show Business, which has been on air for 24 years. And, you know, he's the publisher of Caviar Lifestyle, which talks about high gastronomy, high fashion, and, you know, I've been reading a little bit.
Is he basically Sao Paulo's Donald Trump?
A little bit. I mean, the only thing that instead of suits, I mean, he loves sweaters around his neck. In fact, he stopped doing that because people don't like it. He should be a little bit more informal in a way.
Okay. Well, I mean, there is a serious backdrop to this, of course, that these elections go on at a period of extraordinary national political turmoil in Brazil. In Britain, the conventional tradition is during regional elections away from a general election. It's where everybody just queues up to give the national government a bit of a kicking. Is that what's going to happen in Brazil?
Absolutely. But I think it'll be a huge kick. It'll be annihilation.
Not a bit of a kicking.
No, not really. And I have to say, these elections is very relevant, Andrew, because in Brazil we have 5,570 cities. All of them are voting for mayor. And I have to tell you something. In Brazil, we call cities. It doesn't matter if you live in São Paulo with 12 million people or in the little district of Borá with only 800 people. So everybody's voting. And even in São Paulo, the mayor, Fernando Haddad, from the Workers' Party, he's actually in fourth with only 10%. I mean, to be honest, I think he did quite a good job. But, you know, just to be associated with the Workers' Party is not doing him any favors at all. So that's why people are going to vote for a candidate who has a magazine called Caviar Lifestyle. I mean, I don't mind caviar, but I really think it's quite a weird...
We will doubtless look into that story in more detail as it goes on. But finally tonight, we have Marcus Hippie, another Monocle 24 producer here. Basically, Marcus, we've just invited you in to vent your spleen at the Indian Embassy. Because is this your first attempt to visit India?
No, I have been in India before and it's never been this difficult. Maybe because for this time they have decided that if you work as a journalist, you have to apply for a journalist visa regardless what the reason for you want to go to India is.
I know the feeling that I have in my time applied for a couple of Indian visas. I gave up eventually and got an agency.
Time I've been filling a journalist visa application and they required also a document from my employer, Monocle, stating that I am not going to be working in India. And I don't know if that actually...
Because I've had to get Monocle to write letters saying this man works for us. If they had to write one saying he doesn't work for us.
I don't know if I'm breaking the local rules now if I check my emails every now and then, if I ever get to India. Anyway, after looking for 2x2 inches special size visa photos, having filled application asking me for a local Indian reference, after having tried to prove that I actually live in the UK, after having looked for a utility bill from the year 2014 and 16, I was feeling quite confident this morning, but I was turned away. And you know why that was?
Do tell us.
My utility bills didn't match. The other one was a council tax bill from 2014. The other one was a water bill from 2016.
Marcus.
And they could not possibly trust me basing on those documents that I live in this country.
You can't just let someone into your country who has a water bill and an electricity bill. I mean, that would be insane.
Exactly. The last time when I was in India, they tried this system called visa on arrival, and that sounded really good. The idea was that I fly to Delhi and apply for my visa at the airport. I thought it was a very good idea until I reached Delhi airport and spent 4 hours queuing and waiting. That process included my money being returned to me because the shift changed behind the till, so they had new guys taking care of that
Fantastic.
Business.
Fantastic. The best advice I was ever given about dealing with Indian bureaucracy was never ask why and never ask when. It's just, you just kind of have to submit yourself. It is awesome.
India has been running this amazing campaign, Incredible India, for 14 years, and I think they could just save the money from that campaign and just fix something when it comes to visa applications.
You guys are talking about India, but can I tell a little bit about my story with the US, actually?
Please.
I spent a day in the American Embassy in 2011, and they rejected my visa. I wanted to spend Christmas in New York. And, you know, and I asked, but why? And they said, you're young and single. And now I'm old and partnered, so I do have a visa.
That reminds me, my Finnish friend was actually turned away and she was told to go and find a new visa application photos because she was revealing too much cleavage in her photos, she was told.
Excellent. I think our signing off advice there is, if you do want a visa to go to India, seriously, it is worth the money to get an agency to do it. It's days of your life you get back. Thank you both for joining us, Marcus and Fernando. That is the end of today's episode of Midori House. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Beatrice Carmi. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. More music next at 1900. Marcus is back with The Menu. I'm back with The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Bye.